Well, good morning, everybody, and thanks for joining our next session. I'd like to welcome Rudy Adolf, CEO of, and founder of Focus Financial, and the firm's CFO, Jim Shanahan. Focus is a leading RIA franchise that has experienced significant growth over the years, capitalizing on the many structural drivers in the wealth management industry. Despite what's been, of course, a tougher backdrop so far this year, Focus continued to execute on its growth strategy, announcing 24 transactions this year and delivering north of 20% EBITDA growth year to date. We look forward to getting an update from Rudy and Jim on how the firm's navigating today's environment and, of course, get your thoughts into 2023, given the time of the year. Thank you both for being here. Always great to have you.
Thanks for having us.
Actually, welcome back. As we were saying earlier, we missed you last year because you had your Investor Day the following day, so you had to skip.
That's right, yeah.
But not this year. So look, maybe we could start with a couple questions around the M&A environment and the deal activity in the RIA industry. And, you know, the first question I have is really 2023. We've seen a pretty tough backdrop in this year. You guys still managed to announce a pretty healthy number of transactions. So, what are your current dialogues like with prospective targets, and what is your outlook for deals into 2023, especially if markets remain somewhat volatile here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you said 24. That was last week. We announced 28 deals year to date, of which six are partner firms, yeah, 22 are mergers. So we had a terrific year. Yeah, and it's not just the number of deals. The way we look at it is, of course, is capital deployed, is, yeah, the quality and diversity of the deals that we are doing. And we are not fully done yet for this year. There will be some more announcements. And the way we look into next year is, yeah, momentum is terrific. I said this last year on Investor Day, or the, basically, this industry is not in consolidation in this industry, our M&A business is not really dependent on, you know, whatever, market volatility. It's ultimately fundamental drivers, you know, that, you know, first and foremost, it's the aging of the founding generation, yeah, in this industry. It's the benefits of scale from an, yeah, advisor from economics, and quite frankly, it's ever-increasing needs of the client, you know, that really drives scale, the need for scale, and we are facilitator of scale. So fantastic year in 2021, our best year ever, 38 deals. Year to date, we announced 28 deals, and I'm very optimistic as we look into next year.
Yeah. Let's spend a couple of minutes on deal economics and really the impact of rising interest rates on how that impacts financials for the type of transactions you guys do. So spend maybe a couple of minutes on what returns you're currently underwriting to in today's environment, and does this regime change impact your deal funnel in terms of the prices you are able to pay, which could, you know, let some companies fall out of the opportunity set?
Yeah. Actually, we always publicly disclose here, we use a 20% hurdle rate. Yeah, typically, returns that we generate are at 25%. Over half of our deals create returns well in excess of 30%. Yeah. So basically, whenever we deploy capital, yeah, we create very, very attractive returns. And you know what? Yeah, financial theory hasn't been abolished. Rates are up, multiples are down. Yeah, so reality is we really like what we see from a multiple dynamics perspective. And quite frankly, what is unique for the deals right now, probably next year, is because we ultimately buy on a run rate. Yeah. So in reality, of course, run rates just based on market dynamics are impacted. So we have an embedded tailwind in every deal that we currently are doing when things normalize.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they will normalize at one point. Who knows when, but they will. That ultimately, we believe these current vintages of transactions are probably going to be some of the best we have ever done, which is why it is so important for us to sustain the deal momentum. Yeah, and we clearly are demonstrating this. I feel very good about next year. But one opportunity that we currently have, and we announced this during the third quarter earnings call, is basically that we can now because of a lower competitive intensity in the M&A business, we can now structure deals where the upfront multiple, yeah, is basically accretive to our current leverage target range. That is really attractive, and that really allows us to continue doing what we are doing and ultimately deploying capital at very attractive returns for years to come, almost independently where our balance sheet may be at that-
Yeah.
any given point in time.
We'll spend a little bit more time on deal structure, but before we
yep.
go there, I was hoping we could just touch on the competitive dynamics in the landscape there that you mentioned. So, you know, clearly we've seen a lot of new players coming into the space, paying very aggressive multiples in the RIA industry over the last couple of years. How much has that changed? I know you mentioned the purchase multiples have come down, so
yep.
hopefully it's partially a reflection of fewer competition, but how has that changed?
Yeah.
And I guess how permanent is that?
Yeah, what's interesting is, yeah, 2021, there were some new players coming in, and Alex, it was a little bit amateur's hour. Yeah, there were people paying just insane multiples. Guess what? Yeah, they used their powder and fundamentally are not a factor. Yeah, in 22 and in my judgment, probably in the future. So there's this rationalization. Yeah, that we are seeing, and to some degree, yeah, even when yeah, like in 2021, yeah, it was foreign players, you know, asset managers, and others who just don't have the competence in this industry in reality, and ultimately overpaid massively. It didn't really impact us that much directly. We still did 38 deals.
Yeah,
we deployed more capital than ever in our history at very good multiples. Why can we do that? It's the uniqueness of our value proposition. Yeah, ultimately, firms join us. Yeah, you want to be an entrepreneur. You want to have access to real, tangible, value-added capabilities, tried and proven. And you want permanent capital. Focus is the only game in town. Yeah, there are others with different propositions, and obviously we don't have this industry for ourselves. But it is so differentiated. Yeah, and in the core of our proposition, there's really nobody else, which basically allowed us to have a very successful year in 21, have a very successful year this year, and the way I'm looking into next year, I feel very, very good about the future.
Great. Let's talk about capacity first before we kind of get into some of the deal structure. So you're currently at the upper end of your 3.5 to 4.5 leverage target. So one, I guess, let's talk a little bit about your commitment to stay within the range if the deal activity continues to come through. And what does that ultimately mean for your, you know, if you wanted to expand the capacity, where would that come from?
Yeah. Maybe I'll start with you. So obviously our target range is 3.5 to 4.5. Last year we did over 30 deals, and this year we've signed or closed 28 deals at this point in time. Earlier this year what we did, we amended our credit facility for the revolver to change the maturity date of a revolver to June of 24. So at
yep.
some point we were going to refinance our credit before June 23 so it wouldn't be current. So what we did late November was we amended our entire credit facility to push out the maturity dates on that, but it was also to reset the dry powder for our M&A activity. We continue to operate within the range of 3.5 to 4.5, as Rudy says, we structured the deals accordingly, and we're able to transact on that into next year and future years. But one thing that gives us the capital is the credit facility that we just did. So we've reset our $650 million revolver, which is a 5-year maturity date out to November of 27. We added a new term loan for the first time, a term loan A, $240 million. It was supported by many of our long-term lenders, including Goldman Sachs. That has a 9-month delay draw, so we can pull down that credit when we need it for this M&A. And then from our Term Loan B perspective, we increased the size of that by about $162 million. So when you add up those three instruments, 650, 240, 160, we have over $1 billion of dry powder here, not to mention the cash flow that we generate. In the recent earnings call, we disclosed $346 million of LTM cash flow available for capital allocation, so we can redeploy that into the business as well. We selectively use equity. We primarily use cash as our consideration, but that's always an alternative too when we look at our leverage metrics. So we've taken the refinance risk off the table. We have over $1 billion of dry powder. We're generating a lot of cash flow. we're tweaking our deal economics to continue on the growth path and remain within this leverage range.
Now, if you think about in the context of what we said before, the over 50% of our deals create returns in excess of 30%. The impact of this, your credit work that Jim is talking about, is basically after tax, about 230 basis points.
Mm-hmm.
And we entirely eliminated any refinancing risk.
Mm-hmm.
So what it really speaks to is, A, the quality of our balance sheet and how easy it is for us to really take advantage of it. But B, is kind of how we are looking into the future-
Mm-hmm.
And really making sure we have the capacity that we need to sustain the M&A momentum.
Great. Let's talk about sticking with the deal structure topic for one more minute. Let's talk about the deferral structure that you guys started talking about on the last call, in a way that really, I feel, kind of decouples the ability to do deals versus the leverage constraint. Because you're still trying to be within 3.5-4.5, you're the upper end of that.
Yeah.
So, intuitively say, well, you can't really do a whole lot more. This kind of gives you more flexibility. So-
You bet.
Walk us through how that works and what percentage of deals you ultimately expect to come through this deferral structure, and really the client or the target's response to that. Is that something they like?
Yeah.
Is it something they'd rather not have? Kind of how does that work?
Yeah, yeah. One reason it is relatively easy for us to implement is it's actually good news for the seller, and it's good news for us, yeah. When we started Focus, on my kitchen table in 2006, we kind of were a financial perpetuum mobile. Meaning, every time we did a deal, it was usually below our leverage range, so every deal created the capacity for the next deal, yeah? Now, those days where we had a lot of paper and not much cash-
Mm.
Yeah, every deal had to be 50/50, yeah. And of course, the partners who came in just did terrific, yeah, really, really well. Yeah, we started this business at $1.42 per share. So we use some of the same technique. We are just not using equity, yeah? So what we are now doing is basically many of the deals, the upfront consideration is below our leverage target range, so below 4.5, which is based on the initial purchase. And then 3, 4, 5 years later, yeah, basically, we true it up with the other half, yeah, of the purchase price. It's actually relatively easy to negotiate because we are buying on a run rate. So when you're buying on a run rate, per definition, in the current market, yeah, you got headwinds, yeah, so your run rate is down, yeah? So what it does is it creates an alignment between the seller and us, you know, where when run rates improve, which they probably will, yeah, in at one point, certainly, hopefully, the next 3, 4, 5 years, they get the benefit of an improved run rate. We get the benefit of deferral, yeah, which de facto, and this is a big deal when you think about how we are deploying capital, deals now are at least neutral to leverage. Some of them are accretive to leverage, creating, putting us back into the, you know, financial perpetuum mobile days, you know, that we started. And this in an industry that will continue to consolidate, in an industry where you've got some softening of multiples, in an industry that, per definition, will have these tailwinds, you know, that will kick in at one point, it creates a terrific opportunity for us. And that is one of the reasons why I'm really so optimistic about 2023 and thereafter.
Great. All right, let's shift gears a little bit and pivot from M&A and deal activity to organic growth. So market's obviously challenged. If we look at the lower equity and fixed income markets on the business, naturally, there's gonna be some mark-to-market effect, and that flows through your financial model. But if you kind of peel that back and you look at the organic growth at your partner firms, excluding markets and excluding any kind of firm-level M&A they do-
Yeah.
I think in the past, you talked about that being sort of in the mid-single-digit range. How's that been tracking so far this year, and what's sort of the outlook you're getting from that kind of true organic growth from your-
Yeah.
partner firms into next year?
Yeah. So, as you know, the average Focus partner firm grows almost 15% a year. You take out... Well, Focus as a whole, empirically, has grown at 30% a year, yeah. Then our partner firms, roughly 15% a year, we disclose this every quarter. You take out the M&A business, you know, you are at about, you know, 10% same-store growth. So this is basically market impact. Market impact is very easy to estimate. You look at the typical performance of a 55-45 portfolio, and, you know, this is usually in the kind of mid-single digits. And, the delta is true core growth, the way, you would think about it, which is ultimately more money from existing clients, minus, distributions, plus money from new clients. And, this is actually a relatively consistent number over time. Yes, it is currently lower than what you would typically see, simply because there are not enough liquidity events. Yeah, we are primarily in the ultra-high net worth and high net worth segment, and, therefore, a very important driver of our core growth is more money from existing clients.
Mm-hmm.
More money from existing clients means people sell their businesses, people, you know, exercise option positions, you know, concentrated stock or similar, and this obviously is less active in a market like this. So really going back to what we discussed, Alex, before, this will turn around at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this then speaks to the embedded momentum, you know, that we believe we have in our existing portfolio, yeah, and with new transactions. So when there is this change in sentiment, yeah, quite frankly, this is when these forces that, of course, are driving us down today, come back with a vengeance, yeah? And that's really the embedded opportunity that we see, and it's going to through every single component of our business model, including core organic growth.
Understood. Understood. Some of the things we've been talking about in the last couple of years now are some of the capabilities that Focus brings to your partner firms in an effort to really accelerate their organic growth, right? Because you guys-
Yep.
Don't charge for them explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the model. You benefit when your partner firms benefit. So whether it's things like tax insurance, alternative, et cetera, and all the things you've been rolling out, it's sort of meant to accelerate the organic growth. So maybe talk a little bit about how the uptake of some of these services has been, and any evidence you can share with us how that ultimately accelerates organic growth at the partner firm level.
Yeah. Yeah. So, really the purpose of Investor Day a year ago is to explain that, you know, I grew up a professional at McKinsey, so I think in S-curves. You're jumping to the next S-curve, yeah? When we started business, there was proof of concept, rapid growth. Now we enter the stage, how can we take advantage of this unique growth that we have in this industry globally, to ultimately create a better solution for the end client, to create a better solution for our partners, and of course, ultimately benefit from this, as shareholders. And, really what is driving these activities today on the client-facing services, what we call Focus Client Solutions, it starts with alternatives, access to superior alternative solutions that many of our partner firms simply could, would not have with, without being a partner in Focus. It is access to cash, access to credit, trust services, P&C, life insurance. At one point, we'll be talking more about multifamily office services that will be part of this. And all of these are about bringing the best that the market can offer to the end client by leveraging this unique scale that we have. To give you a couple of kind of data points, our alternative program we launched very recently, maybe it's 18 months or so ago, with our partner from SCS, as the, if you want, the bell cow in the program. Yeah, at this point, they have over $300 million of capital already managed. There's another at least $500 million of commitments. Yeah, that's-
That's from within the network?
That's just from within, yeah, with by opening up their strategies. Yeah, this will be soon $1 billion. Yeah, this, these are very big numbers in the world of alternatives, in the RIA space. Credit, since the inception of the program about 2 years or so ago, we have worked on $3 billion of credits, in an advisory capacity, where, again, our, it's not our balance sheet. yeah? But we use our unique scale to provide superior access to a network of, I guess it's 60 banks at this point, yeah, who are specialists in different areas. So strategically, we really brought the concept of open architecture to the world of private banking. This has never been done before. Mm-hmm. And doing this with the depth and the access of, yeah, arguably by distance, the largest player in this industry, yeah, this gives us a competitive advantage and ultimately an advantage that really touches the end client directly, yeah, in a way that certainly has never been done before. And that helps us better serve clients. It helps, therefore, with organic growth. It helps with M&A because it is a core component of our value proposition. So it is literally this next S-curve, you know, that Focus is entering and is still at an early stage, but there's tremendous scale opportunity.
Yeah, our advisors expect more. Clients are constantly expecting more. You know, we just had some investor meetings this morning, and we were given two tangible examples. There was a large wirehouse advisor who recently left, ultra high net worth, and what was critical to that transition was to have credit capabilities for the clients to come to the RIA channel. We're one of the few that can offer that capability. Mm-hmm. If we didn't have 10 specialists in credit, that transaction would never have happened for our partner firm down in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Likewise, one of our MDs just was working with our partner in the West Coast, and it was sort of a competitive transaction. And what the client was really looking for was a one-stop solution for all of estate plan and trust solutions and so forth. And we brought that to the table, and the client joined us. So it is still early days, but these value-add services are really starting to resonate in different ways across the partnership.
Maybe one more example, just to bring it to life. Yesterday, I talked to a prospect. He's spending probably $200,000-$300,000 just on P&C insurance. Mm. And he's probably underinsured. You know, he probably should be doing more. He's doing it with one of the big writers. And the ability to have objective advice, you know, objective from a fiduciary to really help him, well, you know, maybe this is the right rider for this, this is this, here you have a hole here. When he talks to his broker today, well, all he wants to do is sell him more insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So when you are in have a complex here financial life and you have access to these capabilities, whether it's P&C insurance, life insurance, credit, trust, any of these areas, where else can you get this type of service?
Right.
Yeah. That's really differentiating.
Right. Let's keep moving down the list of some of the strategic initiatives you guys have been focusing on. Connect is definitely one of the bigger ones that that I think really resonated with a lot of investors when you rolled that out. So maybe walk us through kind of how this offering is performing in current markets and maybe providing us sort of with an addressable market that you think exists for something like that.
Yeah, so Connectus in many ways was a missing link. Yeah, we had our thriving merger business. Yeah, we of course have the holding company deals, but we needed a proposition that is kind of in the middle, which shares infrastructure, shares capabilities, and therefore, quite frankly, is a higher margin business for us. And this is what Connectus is proving to be. It is already growing at extremely high rates. It will be one of our largest partner firms in a very short time frame if you kind of use a partner firm framework. And at this stage, of course, we just announced it recently, it's still about getting the platform right, hiring the right people, you know, starting it on a very robust foundation.
Mm-hmm.
We have it in Australia already quite well established. We have it in the US. Yeah, there are some other markets where we are going to scale it. So still early days. We like what we see. It proves the concept that it's going to be a higher margin business. And we still have to see a little bit when is it the right answer, when it's not a merger, when it's not a holding company mm-hmm. deal. I think this will evolve over time, quite frankly. Over time, we probably will have existing focused partner firms, you
right.
know, who will look at this as a very attractive platform and are simply going to opt into this model.
Mm-hmm.
What is most exciting for us is this is a model where we kind of have more influence, we can really demonstrate techniques, platforms, capabilities to the rest of our 88 partner firms. That has a very kind of very strategic potential that goes just beyond the numbers.
Got it. Great. All right, let's shift gears. Maybe spend a couple of minutes we have on the clock here, on some of the financial targets, and some of the guidance items. I guess if we look at 2022, especially all things considered, it's been a pretty robust year for the firm. I think earnings per share is still on track to grow somewhere probably in the teens, just based on kind of the guidance that you provided for the fourth quarter. If market conditions remain fairly challenging, not saying, you know, equity markets go down like 20%, but kind of, you know, range bound, somewhat volatile, how are you thinking about the ability to sustain this type of EPS growth into 2023?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is, regardless of model, markets, what you see is stability of cash flows, stability of earnings in our model kind of across all cycles. So it's certainly a well-designed model. And what a lot of investors are starting to do now is they're starting to delineate the components of our model and what kind of drives the earnings. So obviously, we've just reported 23.9% of our revenues are not correlated to the market. So you have about $500 million of the business that, you know, regardless of market conditions, is still growing, you know, nicely here. And this is outsourced CFO services. We charge hourly, fixed retainers, and so forth. So they look at that first slice, if you will, of our financial models, which generates the earnings and the EPS. Then the second thing that they look at, especially during times of market volatility, and less during bull markets, is the slide we have every earnings call of our preference.
Mm-hmm.
So over the last several years, we generally buy between 40%-60% of the cash flows. We have $155 million of cash flows, so this is sort of a nice comfort level during times of volatility to continue to show the stability of our earnings for future years. And then the third piece that they sort of look at is, okay, there's many partner firms that have grown well beyond the preference that have been with us for many years. But even in that situation, we still monetize between 40%-60% of the cash flow, and that's a variable nature. So you have stability there of the base model. You add on all the mergers that Rudy mentioned, the new partners, stay within the leverage capacity. You know, you're able to drive good earnings there. Now, the benefit of amending the credit facility was you take the refinance risk off the table, and you create the dry powder, but that did come with a higher interest expense component. So that will be a bit of a headwind for us into 2023. But we've been building this model for many years, working with Rudy since 2006, and, you know, we're driving the long-term earnings growth double digits over time. And as we become more successful and we have new firms join us, that cash flow kind of continues to grow over time. We redeploy it back into the business, which creates additional earning capacity. But we're staying within the leverage confinement. We have a large addressable market for many years to help grow that earnings growth.
Got it. And I guess as a subcomponent to that, EBITDA margins have been a bigger focus for the firm as well. And with the benefits of your adding additional partners and some of the new kind of models that you rolled out, the benefits of scale should really start to kind of kick in. Does that take the back seat at all in the current market condition and current market environment? Or as you look out into 2023, you still think you'll be able to drive EBITDA margin expansion?
Well, I think you kind of go back in history. If you look at 2019-2021, we were able to grow our margins by 3%, and we lived through COVID during 2020. Last year, 2021, our margins were about 25%, adjusted EBITDA margins. This year, certainly a lot of market volatility. About three-quarters of our revenue is market dependent, and we'll probably exit the year around 25% adjusted EBITDA margins as well. So certainly, a large part of the business has market-correlated revenues, but we have all these unique features, the preference, the split in of the cash flow, as I mentioned. And we get the stability of the non-market correlated revenues during these times of volatility. So in the short term, you know, markets could, you know, impact the adjusted margins, but we look at the long-term growth and drive those margin with the value-add services and so forth. But certainly, if markets are depressed on a prolonged basis, we can adjust costs to enhance the margins. But at this point, we're really looking at the growth opportunity with our partners and driving the long-term results.
Yeah.
You know, clearly margins never should be on the back seat. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the ability to sustain the growth, yeah, short, medium, long term is, of course, the priority, and our numbers speak for themselves.
Yeah. Let's zoom out a little bit. We started this conversation with your Investor Day and the targets you set out for 2025. So maybe it's a good place to go back and just get a quick health check on that as well. So, you talked about $1.1 billion of adjusted EBITDA, almost two times where you were, almost two times where you're tracking really for 2022. I guess with everything we talked about today and tougher market conditions, what's your ability to still achieve these targets? Kind of how do you feel about them now?
Yeah. Well, obviously, we brought them out in, we announced them in Investor Day last year, which feels like 100 years ago.
Right.
From an economic environment. But clearly, if the markets just freeze where we are, it would be impossible to make these goals. But reality is, you know, Alex, for every 2020, there's a 2021. Yeah, and yeah, for every difficult time, yeah, there's a recovery. And depending on whatever this momentum is, yeah, 2021 was the best year probably in our history, or certainly one of the very best years of our history. Yeah, this thing can turn around very, very quickly.
Right.
If there's a more steady recovery, that's fine, too. Yeah, maybe it pushes out by a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's when you put out this type of aspiration, it's a number, of course, it's a number, but I think much more important, it's about the potential. And it is about describing what we believe is just an unlimited market, where we are the market leader globally. And, yeah, maybe it's a year or two later, but reality is we are there. We are showing enormous resiliency in good times, and we have this terrific ability to recover when things change. So I'm not sure what the right year is right now, but we are going to get there, and I feel very, very good about the strategic trajectory that we are on.
Great. Well, fair enough. The last question that I have, and if we have time, we can turn it over to the audience. But I did want to touch on share repurchases. Stock's valuation is clearly not expensive relative to the growth you've been delivering, but you've been very limited in terms of share buybacks. What gets you to be ultimately more aggressive here?
Yeah. So, we were very careful when we announced our authorization. It's not a strategic repurchase program. Yeah, given all the opportunities we discussed, given the terrific momentum on the M&A side, that's the best way for us to continue deploying capital. But, we basically got the authorization that in case there is some other disruption that is, you know, way beyond of what we are seeing so far, we have the capacity to step in. We will step in. Jim and I know exactly what the kind of the right entry point would be. We are clearly not at this entry point at all. But ultimately, we work for our shareholders. Yeah, when the right prudent allocation of capital is to buy back our stock, we are ready, we can do that. But most certainly, given the strategic discussion that we had, yeah, we are not at this point, and quite frankly, the opportunity is just unlimited, and this is how we are running the business, and this is what we are positioned for.
Okay. All right, fair enough. One or two minutes on the clock, so if there are questions, we could take maybe one from the group. All right. Well, one up here, please.
Hi, you describe a really nice capital allocation potential. Do you feel like you're a little constrained on the resources you have today? Would you want to deploy even more capital than you can, you know, even though you're kind of governing yourself? I'm just trying to get a sense of-
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely, it's a very good question, and the opportunity focus is not opportunity constraint. Yeah, it is ultimately, we are growing the business prudently and the scale that we have. Could we double the deployment in capital? Yeah, we probably could, and it would have only a marginal impact on returns. You know, of course, we manage the business in all of its facets. I think we are deploying capital as is appropriate, but no, we are not opportunity constrained. Yeah, both in the U.S. and in international markets, there are opportunities way beyond of what we are doing today. But it's also, quite frankly, it's a good thing in so many ways because it's a discipline. Yeah, our job as capital allocators is to put the capital to its best opportunities. So, you know, we are cutting off many deals that, quite frankly, yeah, could be attractive, but ultimately we go to where the opportunity is, and that creates a certain discipline in the business model that we have demonstrated for years and years now.
Great. All right. Well, we're perfectly at time, so thank you everybody for joining. Rudy, Jim, thank you so much for being here. Always a pleasure. Thanks.